Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls paper, The Courier, for Thursday, July 28, 2022. I'm your reader, Mary Dove. Listeners, if it happens to be your birthday today, you share it with actor Daryl Hickman from The Grapes of Wrath is 91. Cartoonist Jim Davis of Garfield is 77. So here's the Garfield cartoon for today. Get your jollies. Garfield and is wishing John a happy birthday. And then he stares intently at John. John says, "What?" Garfield, "I was told there would be cake." Well, happy birthday, Jim Davis. Linda Kelsey from Lou Grant is 76. Singer Jonathan Edwards is 76. Actor Sally Struthers is 75. Guitarist Steve Morse of Deep Purple is 68. CBS News anchor Scott Pelley is 65. Bassinist Mark Perlman of the Jayhawks is 61. And actor Michael Hayden from Murder One is 59. And actor Lori Loughlin from Full House is 58. All right, listeners, let's take a look at the front page of today's Courier. We have Reynolds picks justice, carbon pipeline input sought, comfortable kitty condos, and cities may still seek river project grant. All right, let's start with our lead story today for Thursday, July 28th. Reynolds picks justice. Governor chooses May as her fifth appointee to the Iowa Supreme Court by journalist Aaron Murphy, Courier, Des Moines Bureau. Des Moines. David May, a state appeals court judge from Polk City, is the newest Iowa Supreme Court justice, Governor Kim Reynolds said Wednesday as she announced her fifth appointment to the seven-member court. May replaces former Justice Brent Appeal, who retired this year upon reaching the state-mandated state Supreme Court retirement age of 72. Appeal was the court's last remaining member appointed by a Democratic governor, Tom Vilsack, in 2006. The other two members were appointed by then-Governor Terry Branstad, a Republican. May, 51, was a finalist for an Iowa Supreme Court vacancy in 2020. For the current vacancy, he was chosen from among three finalists. At every point in this decision, Judge May at the Iowa Court of Appeals stood out for his experience, his approach to interpretation, and his commitment to judicial restraint, Reynolds said during a news conference. A graduate of Drake University Law School, May has been serving on the Iowa Court of Appeals since 2019. Previously, he was a district judge in Central Iowa's 5th Judicial District. May said he is excited to begin his work on the Supreme Court. "I know the work will involve new challenges, certainly a different kind of case mix," he said, "but whether you're at the district court or the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court, the basic principles of judging remains the same. Judges don't exercise the powers of the executive and the legislature, so we have a different job. Our job is to decide legal disputes. We call them cases. And we decide those cases based on the law as it is written and consistent with our oath to support the Constitution of the United States and support the Constitution of the state of Iowa." Five judges applied for the most recent Supreme Court vacancy. The state's Judicial Nominating Commission whittled that field down to three finalists, from which Reynolds made her appointment. Justices are paid over $180,000 a year. The other finalists were Alan Heavens, a Northeast Iowa District Court judge from Garnavillo, William Miller, a lawyer from Dorsey and Whitney in Des Moines. While introducing her latest Supreme Court appointment, Reynolds on multiple occasions praised May's judicial philosophy. "He understands that in our system of government, laws are made only by those who are directly accountable to the people, and that as a result, judges should respect the democratic process whenever possible," Reynolds said. Reynolds recently asked the Iowa Supreme Court to overturn a 2018 ruling that created a state right for women to access to abortion services. With a different makeup than the one that made the 2018 ruling, the state Supreme Court overturned the 18 ruling, which put into effect a 24-hour waiting period before a pregnant woman can have an abortion. Combined with the U.S. Supreme Court ruling a week later that eliminated the federal right to an abortion, the ruling cleared the way for more strict abortion restrictions in Iowa. Currently, abortion is legal in Iowa until 20 weeks of pregnancy. Reynolds also asked the Iowa Supreme Court to rehear the case in order to determine what kind of legal scrutiny the court will apply to future abortion restrictions. The court declined that request, sending the question first to a district court judge that one that likely is to return eventually to the Supreme Court. Reynolds is running for re-election to another four-year term. The Democratic challenger in this fall's election, DeGere, issued a statement Wednesday asserting that Reynolds' appointment of May was politically motivated. Iowans deserve leadership that puts them first. The appointment to the Iowa Supreme Court is another effort of Kim Reynolds in line with the Republican Party agenda to pack the courts with justices who do not represent the whole of our great state, DeGere said in the statement. This trajectory is a great danger to our everyday freedoms. The rule of Iowa should be considered with impartiality, not twisted for political gain. May's appointment to the Supreme Court creates a vacancy on the Court of Appeals that Reynolds will now move to fill. The Supreme Court's next oral arguments are scheduled for mid-September, according to the court's calendars. Our next headline on the front page of today's Courier: Carbon Pipeline Input Sought, Meeting Set to Discuss Carbon Capture Plan, by journalist Andy Malone. Public informational meetings have been scheduled next month to discuss a private enterprise proposal to build and operate 1,300 miles of carbon capture and sequestration pipeline. The Navigator Heartline Greenway will end up passing through Bremer, Buchanan, and other nearby counties, but not Blackhawk, according to filings accorded with the Iowa Utilities Board. According to the latest filed project overview, Midwest-based Navigator CO2 Venture, Navigator Heartland Greenway LLC, will capture and store carbon dioxide from rural biofuel and other industrial producers across Iowa, Illinois, Minnesota, Nebraska, and South Dakota through more than 30 receipt points. By doing so, the company contends it is providing its customers with a long-term, cost-effective means to reduce their carbon footprint. Once fully expanded, the pipeline will be capable of transporting and storing approximately 15 million metric tons of carbon dioxide per year, the overview states. Its operation will convert that carbon dioxide to a liquid form, then transport it via pipeline to a permanent underground sequestering site. The original plans were filed with Iowa Utilities Board back in October and did not include Buchanan and Bremer at the time, when nearly 20 receipt points were part of the pipeline. When reached Wednesday, one supervisor in Bremer and another in Buchanan could not recall another time in recent memory when private industry proposed to build such a pipeline. "It's something that's very new for us," said Buchanan County Supervisor Clayton Nort. "We're gathering as much information as we can." At this time, Ort said the board has not considered sending a letter in support or rejection of the pipeline. In Bremer County, Supervisor Tim Neal said the board will be weighing the letter of objection likely Monday in its 9 a.m. regular meeting. His personal objections have to do with eminent domain and not being clear how farmers will be compensated for their land and possible damages. The Iowa Utilities Board remains open to accepting letters. Meetings have been scheduled for local counties. Bremer is 6 p.m. August 23rd at the Center Hall, 1211 4th Street, Southwest Waverly. Buchanan is 6 p.m. on August 22nd, Heartland Acres Agribition Center, 2600 Swan Lake Boulevard, Independence. Butler, noon on August 24th, Green Community Center, 202 West South Street Green. In Delaware County, noon, August 22nd, The Gathering Place, 1711 North 2nd Street, Manchester. Fayette County will be noon, August 23rd, The Coliseum, 101 1st Street Southwest, Owine. Hardin County can be at 6 p.m. August 24th at ECC Agriculture Renewable Energy Center, 509 Ellsworth Avenue, Iowa Falls. Construction is anticipated to begin as soon as the spring of 2024. This multifaceted project will assist customers in constructing and financing carbon dioxide capture equipment, safely transporting the captured CO2 over a newly constructed approximately 1,300-mile pipeline network, and permanently storing the carbon in secure underground sites being actively developed in South Central Illinois, said the project overview. Our third headline for the front page of today's Courier, Comfortable Kitty Condos. The article is accompanied by a colorful picture of new custom-made cat kennels at the Cedar Bend Humane Society have expanded its capacity and comfort for cats awaiting adoption. Custom-made kennels boost holding capacity for Humane Society. By journalist Melody Parker. Waterloo. Furry felines in the market for forever homes at the Cedar Bend Humane Society are now awaiting adopters in comfortable new kitty condos and kennels. Custom-made kennels purchased from Snyder Manufacturing have increased the organization's holding capacity from 60 to 111 in adoption building from 25 to 90 in two rooms of the intake building. We've been working on the cat condo project for over a year. We wanted a better way to accommodate the cats, and these kennels and cat condos better showcase the cats and provide us with better flexibility, said Christy Gardner, CBHS Executive Director. The condos and kennels give the adoption center a whole different feel. It opens up the lobby area and makes it more appealing for adopters to interact with the cats. In addition, the Humane Society has launched a new Sponsor a Kennel fundraiser. Last year, CBHS took in 2,300 cats, including strays and owner surrenders. May to October are our heaviest months. We've had 200 to 300 cats in 1 month. Sometimes whole little litters of kittens, it becomes challenging to make room for everyone. The increased variety of individual and community cat condos will allow CBHS staff and the medical team to better meet the personal and health needs of every cat and kitten in the shelter. Cats are spayed, neutered, vaccinated, and receive any necessary medical care before being adopted. We always have cats that need medical care or special food or have other needs that have to be met. We deal with lots of fleas and ear mites and other issues. Cats come in with upper respiratory issues. It's like kids at a daycare center. You don't know what the cats have been exposed to when they come in, and they can pass something along to other cats. Cats have been relocated from large community cat rooms into smaller colonies and individual living quarters, which has made for healthier, happier, and less stressed cats. Kennels have perching shelves and portals that can be opened up to allow passage between kennels. They were designed to fit the space, but can easily move and be repositioned if necessary. Upgrades were made possible by generous donations in memory of Linda Dobby, June Jacobs, and Callie Corwin, as well as from Sue Lund, Gardner said. The community also can support the program through Sponsor a Kennel. CBHS sets no time limit on how long homeless pets wait for adoption and is committed to finding them loving homes no matter how long it takes. Sponsoring a kennel helps the shelter provide hundreds of animals in their care with food, bedding, toys, and medical care until adoption. We are thankful for all the donations we receive from the community. It has allowed us to move forward with the project. Sponsoring a kennel means we can continue to give oral daily care to these animals until they get a home and donors will be individually recognized, Garner said. There are $100 to $200 to $300 giving levels and various sponsor options. A custom sign recognizing a donor will be installed on a cat kennel, and the individuals, group, or business making the donation will be invited to the shelter to take a photograph with the adoptable pet, share it on its organization's Facebook page. Visit cedarbendhumane.org for more details, or contact the Cedar Bend Humane Society Marketing and Events Coordinator, Mackenzie Ellis, at cedarbendmarketing@gmail.com for more information. And our last story on the front page of today's Courier, cities may still seek river project grants. Still haven't applied for Destination Iowa funds. By journalist Andy Malone. Waterloo. It's still up to the air in the air whether Waterloo and Cedar Falls will vie for funding from an initial pool of $100 million for COVID-19 federal relief dollars to help finance transformational attractions and improvements along and nearby the Cedar River. Officials with the two cities reportedly were dreaming big when it came time earlier this year to consider a potentially lucrative opportunity, a Destination Iowa joint application. They had been working with Isaiah Corbin, community planner with the Iowa Northland Regional Council of Governments, and Carrie Dara, CEO and president of Grow Cedar Valley. However, the ball is apparently in Waterloo's court at this point in time. Most recently, Dara framed it in an email Monday as, "We're kind of on hold until Waterloo makes a decision on the application." She didn't include any specifics about the decision needed. Any formal grant application would come before the respective city councils before submission. The City of Waterloo is working through potential funding options and projects to work together with the City of Cedar Falls for a Destination Iowa project, wrote Noelle Anderson, Community Planning and Development Director, in an email Wednesday. The goal is to have the project all be based upon the Cedar River connection, downtown to downtown type mentality. We all share in the community. Hopefully we can work through some of the details in the next few days to see what is possible. Anderson couldn't be reached for further comment. The application could bring in millions of dollars in support of these Cedar Valley public projects. The focus is a new whitewater course in Waterloo, Corbin said a few weeks ago when reached by telephone. That Waterloo Whitewater Park came with a preliminary price tag of $9.5 million back in May. A previous proposal had nearly 1 mile river course spanning from Park Avenue to 6th Street. The Destination Iowa program is administered by the Iowa Economic Development Authority and has been on the radar of city officials since at least April. As of Tuesday, Cannon Kappelman, an IEDA spokesperson, said that 81 Destination Iowa applications were submitted to totaling $188.7 million in requested funding. They range from trail development to water recreation and sporting facilities, she said. Cedar Falls officials previously confirmed they had not been heavily involved in the application. Ann Corbin said the city has more of a minor role in the process, especially after last month receiving $1.5 million from IEDA grant for recreational river improvements. From Main Street Bridge to downstream side of the West First Street Bridge that play in the larger vision local officials have for the Cedar River. The vision is much bigger than what we can accomplish with the grant and has been discussed for years prior to the announcement of the latest grant opportunity. Previously under consideration as potentially part of the application package were a number of anchor projects: the Whitewater Park, Waterloo; 4th Street Bridge Lighting and Towers, Waterloo; Hardcourt Indoor Tournament Center, Waterloo; River Road Parkway, Waterloo; Multimodal Parking Ramp, Cedar Falls; Center Street and Main Street Bridge Lighting, Cedar Falls. Back in May, when Grow Cedar Valley in Intercog, officials came before Cedar Falls City Council to explain more about the Destination Iowa program. Danny Ludick, GCV Senior Program Director in Economic Development, told the Courier its application could be in $30 to $50 million range, although 60% of that would be matched by local sources. It's a possibility that it could or couldn't happen, Corbin said a few weeks ago. Kappelman, the IEDA spokesperson, said funding submissions are being reviewed continuously on a rolling basis, which gives those working on financing or other elements time to assemble a robust application that meets all eligibility requirements. Projects will be announced gradually until December 31st or until funds are exhausted, she said. We welcome eligible project applications to be submitted as soon as they are ready. We are looking to fund transformational attractions and projects, so heightened chances are based on complete and compelling applications, Kappelman said. To date, the IEDA has announced two rounds of awarded projects, the first in June totaling $16.5 million and the second in July totaling $4.65 million. The most recent included $3.5 million to help pave 16 miles along the Cedar Valley Nature Trail and other projects like bridge replacement. All right, let's turn our attention to some Cedar Valley news for Thursday, July 28th. Cancer treatment, first of its kind in state. Waterloo Skin Cancer Center announces new non-surgical method by journalist Donald Prominski. Waterloo, one of the latest breakthroughs in cancer care, has arrived in the Cedar Valley and can be found next to a cornfield off Ridgeway Avenue. On Wednesday, Dr. David Condon, founder of the Cedar Valley Skin Cancer Center, announced the introduction of an image-guided superficial radiotherapy, or CRT, becoming the first clinic in the state to use the method on people. Waterloo Mayor Quentin Hart attended the unveiling and made some comments, as did U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, who spoke via video message. Representatives from the offices of Senator Joni Ernst and Representative Ashley Hinson were also present. According to Congdon, the therapy is used to treat non-melanoma skin cancer, or basal and squamous cell carcinomas, offering them a less invasive alternative to surgery. There's no blood, no pain, no surgical scarring, Condon said. Patients like it because they can go immediately back to work, especially my farmers. They don't want to have a week off or a week and a half off because of recovery. So this is a great benefit for patients because there's basically no recovery with this treatment. It is estimated that over 32,000 people will be diagnosed with non-melanoma skin cancer in Iowa during 2022. Condon will help to combat the disease using new methods in three locations. There are three Sensus CRT 100 vision machines at the Waterloo Clinic, 2515 Cyclone Drive, Suite B. Additional units in his clinic is at 1253 West 4th Street, Southwest Waverly, and 1600 1st Street, Independence, and are expected to go live sometime next week. Condon explained that patients receiving image-guided CRT treatment come in several times a week over the course of several weeks for sessions that last approximately 15 minutes. CRT relies on ultrasound imaging to locate the cancerous cells in the body and determine their depth. X-rays are then used to focus on and eliminate the cells. According to one study published in Oncology and Therapy, CRT had a success rate of 99.3%. The SRT treatment, Condon said, is superficial, goes only a few millimeters into the skin. In case it runs deeper, layers of skin in the area are treated and may be removed. However, he cautioned that there are still scenarios where surgery could be the recommended course of action. For example, if the cancer is growing rapidly, the scalpel may need to be utilized. Let's say someone comes in and it grew from a pencil head to this big in 2 weeks, Condon said, indicating the circle about the size of a golf ball with his fingers. It wouldn't treat them with that. But Condon stated that such instances are rare, and approximately 90% of the cancer patients they see in their office will be able to utilize the SRT and its benefits. It's painless, it's easy, but just the results are better, Condon said. Well, stay healthy, Cedar Valley. Next, Regents approve 4.25% increase hike for fall. All UNI students will see same increase. By journalist Vanessa Miller, The Gazette. Ames. State resident undergrads headed to any of Iowa's three public universities this fall will pay 4.25% more than students did last year after the Board of Regents on Wednesday unanimously approved tuition increases across their campuses. At Iowa State University and the University of Northern Iowa, the 4.25% hike applies to all students, including residents and non-resident graduate and undergraduate. The University of Iowa is imposing the same 4.25% increase to all of its resident students, amounting to a $355 bump for undergraduates and $443 hike for graduate students. But rather than applying the same percentage increase to non-residents at both levels, the University of Iowa is making even the dollar increase for students from outside Iowa, amounting to a 1.2% increase for non-residents, undergrads, and 1.5% increase for non-resident graduate students. For students in costlier programs, the campuses have applied varying tuition rates across all levels, amounting to some bigger percent and dollar increases, like $2,000 to $3,000 plus hikes for some University of Iowa dentistry programs. The tuition increase, which the board said were compelled by weaker than requested funding increase from the Iowa legislature, will amount to meaningful revenue bumps for the University of Iowa and ISU when paired with enrollment projections, according to fiscal 2023 budget documents the board approved Wednesday. University of Iowa expects its tuition revenue to increase to $20.1 million, or 4.3% this year. With the expected tuition increase and enrollment changes, ISU is looking at $12.8 million bump in tuition revenue, or 4.8% above last year, due, like the University of Iowa, to rate hikes and enrollment projections. The University of Iowa projected tuition revenue increase in its biggest since at least 2017. ISU projected increase to its largest since 2018, having budgets for a $26 million tuition revenue bump in 2017. UNI, unlike the University of Iowa and Iowa State University, this year is expecting a drop in tuition revenue, despite its rate increases, possibly hinting at its enrollment projections, which have not been made public yet. With the projected enrollment and the proposed tuition rate for the fiscal year of 2023, tuition revenues are $2.9 million less than the previous year's budget, according to Regent documents. Including this year, UNI has projected declining tuition revenue for 5 straight years, with its last increase coming in 2017, when it budgeted for a $2.6 million increase. The campuses report heavy reliance on tuition revenue for their general operations. The University of Iowa reports tuition comprises 63% of its $768 million general university revenue budget, with 28% coming from state appropriations. Tuition income accounts for 71% of Iowa State University and $674.8 million general university revenue, with 26% coming from the state. University of Northern Iowa, conversely, reports 59% of its general operating revenue comes from the state appropriations, with tuition accounting for 40% of the budgeted revenue. With the base tuition increases approved Wednesday, resident undergrads will pay $8,711 at the University of Iowa, $8,878 at the Iowa State University, and $8,111 at the University of Northern Iowa. Combined with new fees and room and board rate increases, the total cost of attendance for resident undergrads this coming year is estimated at $26,686 at the University of Iowa, $23,471 at Iowa State University, and $21,988 at the University of Northern Iowa. Well, good luck to all our college students as they head back to College Student. All right, next up, we have Testimony Begins in Suit Over Lead Exposure by Jeff Renounci, Waterloo. Testimony has started in the lawsuit brought by a mother whose child was hospitalized with high levels of lead in his bloodstream. Victoria Furman took her landlord, Chase Keller, and his company, Ham Sandwich LLC, and Level Property Management LLC, to court, alleging he failed to disclose the presence of lead paint when she rented an apartment at 303 Logan Avenue in December of 2018. Furman said her child now needs an individualized learning plan at school, suffers from behavior problems. He breaks things and tries to hurt others and himself, banging his head on the floor when he doesn't get his way. She said she can't take him out in public because of his disruptive behavior. I still love my child, but I can never have that same child I had before, Fulman said Tuesday while taking the stand. The two moved into Logan Avenue apartments when her son was 2 years old, and lead was found in the boy's system during a duct in February of 2019. The levels didn't subside, and he was hospitalized at the Unity Point Allen Health for 8 days. X-rays showed lead in his digestive system. Furman said her son's lead level was 46 micrograms of lead per deciliter. Experts say no level of lead is safe, and the Center of Disease and Control indicate a level of 3.5 micrograms is above normal. Her attorney, Bradley Casper, told jurors the house, which was built in 1895 and later divided into apartments, was tested by the Blackhawk County Health Department. There was lead paint everywhere, and readings indicated it was a hazardous condition, Casper said. Ingesting lead, which usually happens when children eat flaking paint, can have ill effects on a developing brain. Casper said doctors who treated the son said his lead levels were among the highest they had seen in a patient. He said the child's behavior issues were consistent with lead exposure. Defense attorney Brian Marty argued that Keller had provided Fulman with an EPA-approved brochure entitled Protecting Your Family from Lead in Your Home, as Required by Law, when she began renting. He also repaints apartments between every change in tenant. He said the first time the landlord knew the lead paint in the Logan apartment was when the health department tested. The defense said the child had also stayed with his grandmother at a Kern Street address, which hasn't been tested by the health department, suggesting there may have been other sources for the lead. And the child was also found with an elevated lead level and lead in his digestive tract 8 months after they moved out of the Logan Avenue apartment, Marty said. The Logan Avenue building was sold to another company in 2020. Listeners, you are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls paper for Thursday, July 28, 2022, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Earlene C. Trainer Pint of Independence passed away peacefully on July 26, 2022, in Iowa City of natural causes. She was born December 29, 1944, the daughter of Earl Trainer and Evelyn Butler, Trainer Buckingham. She was a 1963 graduate of Jefferson High School in Independence. Earlene was united in marriage to the love of her life, Richard J. Pint on June 22, 1963, in Independence. Together, they raised two daughters, Lisa and her husband Kurt Hildebrandt of Waterloo, and Linda and her husband Tim of Dyersville. Side by side for over 54 years, they built their ground up. Pint's excavating, retiring in 2017. They are blessed with six grandchildren and six great-grandchildren. They enjoyed watching NASCAR, racing, and Western movies, but most of all, simply spending time together. She was preceded in death by both her parents, her stepfather, Albert Buckingham, both her in-laws, Joseph and Francine Pint, stepbrother Kurt Buckingham, and stepsister Sherry Walker and Joyce Beckhold. Services will be 10:30 a.m. Saturday, July 30th, 2022, at St. John's Catholic Church in Independence, with the burial at St. John's Cemetery in Independence. Visitation will be Friday, July 29th, 2022, at Reef Funeral Family Center in Independence from 4 to 8 p.m., with a 4 p.m. rosary and 1 hour before the service Saturday at the funeral home. Memorials can be directed to the family for future donation. To leave an online condolence, please go to www.reiffamilycenter.com under obituaries. Rex A. Brown, 79, of LaPorte City, died Tuesday, July 26, 2022, at LaPorte City Specialty Care. He was born in Vinton on February 25, 1943, the son of Lawrence and Esther Brown. He graduated from LaPorte City High School with the class of 1961. He married Nancy Ann Geisler on August 24, 1963, in Waterloo. She preceded him in death on March 19, 1984. Rex worked as a printing press operator for Control of Fax for over 20 years. He was a member of the American Lutheran Church in LaPorte City. In his spare time, he enjoyed fishing and dancing. He is survived by his son, Shane, and partner Kim Brown of Waterloo, daughter Brenda, and partner Eddie Smotherman of Tennessee, grandson Chase Smotherman of Tennessee, and brother John and partner Barb Brown of Spokane, Washington. He was preceded in death by his wife Nancy and a brother Joe Brown. A public memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, July 29, 2022, at American Lutheran Church in LaPorte City. A public visitation will be held from 10 until the time of service at the church. Interment will take place in Westview Cemetery. Memorials may be directed to the Cedar Valley Hospice, LOC, in LaPorte City, in charge of arrangements, 319-233-6138, or go to their website, www.lockfuneralservices.com, for more. Death notices: we have Ruby B. Brewington of 87 of Owine, died Wednesday, July 27th, at Mercy One Owine Senior Care. Arrangements are by Jameson Schmidt Funeral Home, Owine. Also in death notices, Priscilla A. Collins, 70, of Manly, died Monday, July 25, 2022, at Gunderson Lutheran Hospital, La Crosse. Arrangements, Jameson Schmidt Funeral Home. Terry Lee Fairchild, 80, of Winthrop, died Tuesday, July 26, 2022, at home. Arrangements, the Reif Funeral Center Family Home and Crematory. Okay, listeners, let's take a look at some sports news. What do we have going on in the world of sports? Northwoods League, Waterloo wins 3 over Larks, by journalist Ethan Petrick, Bismarck. The Waterloo Bucks left for quartet of games against the Bismarck Larks on Monday amid a 5-game losing streak. Since arriving in the capital of North Dakota, all the Bucks have done is win. Waterloo manager Tyler Woolis described the recent winning streak as a product of different areas of stepping up. "It had been a lot of times just the offense," Woolis said. "The winning streak has been winning in different ways. That is the sign of a team starting to figure it out," Pitchers are doing a lot better job limiting free bases, using their defense behind them. Overall, we have played pretty clean defensively these last three games. Willis said a players-only meeting following their fifth straight loss paved the way for the Bucks turnaround. The players have taken ownership of this thing. The players have a meeting themselves after the last game in Wilmar. They brought the group together, voicing different things, encouraging guys to step up. There's a lot of power to a team when players come together like that. Waterloo started its run of success with a 15-5 drubbing by the Larks on Monday. After surrendering one run in the bottom of the first, the Bucks scored four unanswered runs in the second and third inning. Caleb Corbin swiped home a wild pitch to tie the game 1-1 in the top of the second. In the top of the third, Josh Patrick swatted an RBI double to the left field, which scored Clayton Gray from third. During the next at-bat, Ty Walton also scored on a wild pitch while Patrick moved up to third. Patrick capped off the big inning by stealing home to put the Bucks on top, 4-1. Following a two-run response from Bismarck, Waterloo exploded for six runs in the top of the fourth inning. Three unearned runs came across for the Bucks as Tyen, Shahadi, Walton, and Corbin managed to score on a walk, fielder's choice ground out, and wild pitch, respectively. Walton drove in one run with an outfield single, while Corbin recorded two RBIs with an outfield single of his own. Leading 10-3, Waterloo batted around to add three more runs in the top of the fifth. Walton added two RBIs with another outfield single, and Gray scored via bases loaded walk. A two-run home run from Lark's second baseman Jackson Beeman cut Waterloo's lead to an 8-run with 13-5 lead. The Bucks drove in two more runs the top of the ninth to cap off a 15-5 win. On Tuesday, Waterloo picked up where it left off with two wins and a doubleheader against the Larks. Trailing 1-0 with one on and no outs, Carl Kroper clubbed a two-run home run over the right field wall to take a 2-1 lead. Two at-bats later, following a Shaden Kubo walk, Liam Critchard hit another two-run shot over the right field wall to increase Waterloo's advantage to three runs. Score 4-1. After a scoreless fifth inning, the Bucks scored in four consecutive innings to close out the game. TJ McDormand hit an RBI single in the sixth, and Corbett scored via bases-loaded walk in the seventh, and Patrick drove two runs and an RBI double in the eighth. Critchard capped off the 9-3 victory with the second homer, a solo shot, in the top of the ninth. In the second half, the doubleheader, the Bucks needed a bit of the ninth-inning heroics to steal a 6-5 win, a back-and-forth contest. Through the eighth innings, the Bucks managed to tie the Larks twice in the top of the fifth and seventh innings, only to watch Bismarck regain an advantage following the half inning. Entering the final frame, Waterloo trailed 5-3, with its fledgling winning streak on the line. Liam Critchett got the Bucks off to a hot start with a double to center field. A single and a walk from Shahadi and Alex Crouch followed, which loaded the bases. Despite their hot start, Bismarck nearly escaped the jam when McCormick grounded into a potential double, but an error by Bismarck's second baseman Aaron Mann on the throw to first allowed Critchett and Shahadi to score and tie the game. Willis described the at-bat as gritty and said the throwing error was a product of a tough at-bat. It was a power ground ball that took a weird hop on the mound. Sure, it could have been two, but it was good to have some of those breaks go our way. With two outs, Gray drove in the go-ahead run on a single to left field. Leading 6-5, the Bucks retired the Larks in order to secure their third straight win for the first time this season. After their series win against Bismarck, the Bucks head east for a pair of road contests against St. Cloud Rocks on Thursday and Friday at 7:05 p.m. We are looking forward to that challenge, Willis said. Everything that we have done These last three games should create confidence for everybody. Good luck to the Waterloo Bucks. Next up in sports news, Jackie Robinson Museum finally opens, by journalist Ronald Bloom, Associated Press, New York. Long dreamed about and in development for longer than big league career of the man in honors, the Jackie Robinson Museum opened Tuesday in Manhattan with a gala ceremony attended by the 100-year-old wife of the barrier breaker, breaking ball player, and two of his children. Rachel Robinson, who turned 100 on July 19th, watched the half-hour outdoor celebration from a wheelchair in the 80-degree heat, then cut a ribbon to cap a project launched in 2008. Her 72-year-old daughter, Sharon, also looked on from a wheelchair, and 70-year-old son, David, spoke to the crowd about 200 sitting on folding chairs arrayed in a closed-off section of Vacry Street, a major New York thoroughfare, where the 19,380-square-foot museum is located. The issues in baseball, the issues that Jackie Robinson challenged in 1947, they're still with us, David Robinson said. The signs of white only have been taken down, but the complexity of equal opportunity still exists. Rachel Robinson announced the museum on April 15, 2008, at the 61st anniversary of Jackie breaking the big league color barrier with the Brooklyn Dodgers at Ebbets Field. Robinson became the NL Rookie of the Year in 1949, NL Batting Champion and MVP, a seven-time All-Star, and a World Series Champion in 1955. He hit .313 with 141 homers and 200 stolen bases in 11 seasons. Was selected to the Hall of Fame in 1962. Robinson, who died in 1972, had an impact beyond baseball, galvanizing a significant slice of American public opinion and boosting the civil rights movement. There's nowhere on the globe where dream is attached to our name or our country's name, New York City Mayor Eric Adams said. There's not a German dream. There's not a French dream. There's not a Polish dream. Darn it, there's an American dream. And this man and his wife took that dream and forced America and baseball to say, you're not going to be a dream on a piece of paper. You're going to be a dream in life. We are greater because of number 42 and because he had an amazing wife and understood that dreams and visions. A gala dinner was held Monday night to preview the museum, which contains 350 artifacts, including playing equipment, items such as Robinson's 1947 minor league contract for $600 a month and his 1947 rookie contract for a $5,000 salary. The museum also holds a collection of 40,000 images and 450 hours of footage. A 15-piece band played at the ceremony, attended by former pitcher C.C. Sabatin, former NL president Lynn Coleman, and former Mets owner Fred Wolpen, along with Players Association head Tony Clark and Hall of Fame president Josh Rockwich. It seems like we're more divided than ever, King said. People like Jackie Robinson was a great reminder every single morning, every single evening, that we have to do the right thing every day. Original projections had 2010 opening and $25 million cost. The Great Recession caused a delay. Ground finally was broken in 2017 when the Jackie Robinson Foundation said it had raised $23.5 million of a planned $42 million and the museum was intended to open in 2019. The pandemic caused more delays and the total raised has risen to $38 million, of which $2.6 million was contributed by New York City. Tickets cost $18 for adults and $15 for students, seniors, and children when the museum opens to the public on September 5th. Sounds like a good place to go and learn. Okay, next sports story. Campbell works to avoid the spotlight, by Steve Batterson. Indianapolis, Jack Campbell enjoys his role making plays from the linebacker spot in the heart of Iowa football team's defense. Tuesday, Campbell found himself on an island on top of the turf at Lucas Oil Stadium. The Hawkeye linebacker spent an hour perched on top of a small stage, styling in a suit and tie, fielding every question that came his way at the Big Ten kickoff. "There have been a lot of questions," Campbell said during the last of his interview questions. "I appreciate being here, but I am looking forward to getting back on the plane and heading home." That's Campbell, named by a Big Ten media panel on one of the five players to watch in the conference's West Division during the 2022 season. His quiet, business-like approach to things are among the reasons people wanted to learn more about the humble Hawkeye. Campbell told journalists he is mostly concerned with being an effective linebacker. He said he hasn't gotten involved in any name, image, and likes the deals, although he respects the rights of his teammates and others to do so. He simply prefers his focus on the field, where his 143 tackles last season as a junior were the fifth most ever by an Iowa football player. That has positioned Campbell to be named as a first-team preseason All-American and earned spots on nearly every preseason watch list for college football awards he is eligible for. Lists the Cedar Falls Iowa native does what he can to ignore. "For me, I do not pay any attention to it. I try to shut all that stuff down, try not to read any articles. My family does, and they're proud of me, which I guess they can be." As nice as the mentions can be, Campbell insists they won't impact anything he does once Iowa opens preseason camp next week. "It's not going to change the way I play. It's not going to feel any pressure. I'm going to go to have an ego or pride. I'm just going to stay the same Jack Campbell day in and day out. All that knowing that at the end of the day, whatever is happening, it's going to happen. Right now, it's all just verbiage. At the end of the day, we'll find out about all these watch lists and stuff and what it all means." Iowa coach Kurt Ferentz said Campbell possesses the traits it takes to be a successful linebacker. "He's got a skill set that's unusual, just 6'5", height and range. It's a little bit unusual for us historically. I don't know the exact number, but he's probably our tallest linebacker in 23 years," Ferentz said. "Beyond that, he just plays smart and plays with unbelievable desire. I think the first thing I would cite with Jack, and it's probably true of a lot of really good players I've been around, is that he's extremely humble. He's not about taking credit for anything, but he deserves a lot." Well, good luck there. Let's see, we have time for one more sports story before we wrap up. "Mason City Man Jailed in Drug Robbery Sales" by journalist Jeff Renounci, Waterloo. A Mason City man has been sentenced to prison for a 2020 drug robbery in Waterloo and for selling meth and heroin with his father, according to federal prosecutors. Antone Maxwell, 34, was sentenced to 30 years in prison Monday in the U.S. District Court in Cedar Rapids. Following prison, he will be on supervised release for 10 years. Authorities said Maxwell and two others took part in a November 2020 robbery of a marijuana dealer at Shamrock Drive apartment. During the heist, Maxwell had held a gun to the victim's head and threatened to kill him. They fled with marijuana products and more than $1,000 in cash, according to court records. Waterloo police detained the robbers during their attempted getaway. Maxwell and Chavez Harden were convicted of conspiracy to interfere with commerce by robbery. Harden was sentenced to more than 12 years in prison. About a month before the robbery, Maxwell and his father, Charlton Everett Maxwell, were indicted for selling drugs in Mason City between 2018 and 2020. Investigators used controlled drug transactions with the two and others, then searched a home in July of 2020, where they found more than 3 pounds of pure meth, 80 grams of heroin, 4 firearms, court records state. Charlton Maxwell was sentenced to more than 17 years in February. All right, our last story for today. Livestock fraud brings more charges. Another employee of Lynch suspected by journalist Jeff Renounci. Wacoma. Prosecutors have filed charges against another employee in an investigation into fraud at a Wacoma-based livestock dealer. On Wednesday, the government charged Leland Edward Pete Blue with one count of conspiracy to defraud the United States. Blue waived indictment according to court filings. Blue worked in sow marketing at the headquarters of Lynch Livestock, and the government alleges employees at the business routinely downgraded the weights of classification of hogs if purchased at buying stations across the Midwest in order to save money. The plot ran from 1999 until at least May of 2021 and targeted every large corporate account that dealer had with swine producers. Employees allegedly altered scale receipts, then shredded or burned documents when the U.S. Department of Agriculture began investigating the dealer, record court states. Blue began working for the company in 1985 and allegedly joined the conspiracy sometime around 2012, prosecutors allege. Others charged in the investigation include Charlie Francis Lynch, a sow procurement and marketing employee, Billy Joe Bill Wickham, a bookkeeper. Charlie Lynch pleaded guilty on Monday, admitting he created false invoices and indicated he joined and remained in the conspiracy to keep his job. Wickham has filed a notice he intends to enter a plea, court records show. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls paper, Thursday, July 28, 2022. I'm your reader, Mary Dove. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.